From the studios of Books in Motion, this is Cameron Byerly, reading Book 4 of the Malorian, The Sorceress of Darshiva, by David Eddings. We begin with the prologue. Being a brief history of the Eastern Empire, from Emperors of Melsina and Meloria, University of Melsine Press. The origins of the Melsine Empire are forever lost to us. Some legends maintain that the precursors of the Melsines came in rude canoes out of the vast sea lying east of the Melsine Islands. Others contend that the ancestral Melsine was an offshoot of that curious culture existing in Delesia. Whatever the source, Melsina stands as the oldest civilization on the earth. Melsina has always been closely allied with the sea, and her original home lay in the islands off of the east coast of the Malorian continent. The capital at Melsina was a city of light and culture when Tolhonoth was a rude village, and Malzeth was only a shabby cluster of tents. Only Kel stood in contemplation of the heavens to rival the ancestral home of the Melsines. It was the advent of a catastrophe which caused Melsina to abandon its splendid isolation. At a time estimated to be 5,000 years ago, a disaster occurred far to the west. The Angaraks and Elorns blame this on a theological dispute between the gods. Such explanation is not to be taken seriously, but it does give some insight into the gropings of primitive minds to explain the forces of nature. Whatever the source, the cataclysm involved a great split in the proto-continent and engendered colossal tidal waves. The seas first fell, then rose, and ultimately came to rest at more or less the present shoreline. For Melsina, this was disastrous. Fully half of the land area of ancient Melsina was lost to the sea. Although the loss of property was enormous, the bulk of the people were saved. This left a pitifully overcrowded population clinging to the remnants of their former islands. The capital at Melsina had been a fairer city in the mountains, where affairs could be managed without the debilitating effects of the climate in the tropical lowlands. Following the catastrophe, Melsina was a shattered city, destroyed by earthquake and flood, lying no more than a league from the new coast. After a period of rebuilding, it became clear that the shrunken homeland could no longer support the population. Thus, the Melsines turned to the mainland. Southeastern Meloria lay closest, a region populated by peoples of their own racial stock with a compatible, though corrupted, language. To that region, the Melsines turned their attention. There were 5 primitive kingdoms in the area: Gandahar, Darshiva, Telanta, Peldane, and Rengel. These were quickly overrun by the technologically superior Melsines and were absorbed into their growing empire. The dominating force in the Melsine Empire was the bureaucracy. While there were drawbacks to a bureaucratic form of government, it provided the advantages of continuity and a clear-eyed pragmatism more concerned with finding the most practical way to get the job done than with whim, prejudice, and egocentricity which so frequently move other forms of government. Melsine bureaucracy was practical almost to a fault. The concept of an aristocracy of talent dominated Melsine thinking. If one bureau ignored a talented individual, another was almost certain to snap him up. The various departments of the Melsine government rushed into the newly conquered mainland provinces to winnow through the population in search of genius. The conquered peoples were thus absorbed directly into the mainstream of the life of the empire. Always pragmatic, the Melsines left the royal houses of the 5 mainland provinces in place, preferring to operate through established lines of authority rather than set up new ones. For the next 1400 years, the Melusine Empire prospered, far removed from the theological and political squabbles of the Western continent. Melusine culture was secular, civilized, and highly educated. Slavery was unknown, and trade with the Angoraks and their subject peoples in Karanda and Dalasia was extremely profitable. The old capital at Melusine became a major center of learning. Unfortunately, some Melusine scholars turned toward the arcane. Their summoning of evil spirits went far beyond the mumbo-jumbo of the Merindum or the Kerendese, and began to delve into darker and more serious areas. They made progress in witchcraft and necromancy. But the major interest lay in the field of alchemy. The first encounter with the Angoraks took place during this period. Although victorious in that first meeting, the Melusines realized that eventually the Angoraks would overwhelm them by sheer weight of numbers. While the Angoraks bent most of their efforts to the establishment of the Dalesian protectorates, there was a wary tentative peace. The trade contacts between the two nations yielded a somewhat better understanding of each other, though the Melusines were amused by the preoccupation with religion of even the most worldly Angorak. Over the next 1800 years, relations between the two nations deteriorated into little wars, seldom lasting more than a year or two. Both sides scrupulously avoided committing their full forces, obviously not wishing all-out confrontation. To gain more information about each other, the two nations developed a tradition of exchanging the children of various leaders for certain periods of time. The sons of high-ranking Melusine bureaucrats were sent to Malzeth to live with the families of Angorak generals, and the generals' sons were sent to the imperial capital to be raised. The result was a group of young men with cosmopolitanism, which later became the norm for the ruling class of the Melorian Empire. One such exchange toward the end of the fourth millennium ultimately resulted in the unification of the two peoples. At about the age of 12, a youth named Kalath, son of a high-ranking Angorak general, was sent to Melusine to spend his formative years in the household of the Imperial Minister of Foreign Affairs. The minister had frequent official and social contacts with the imperial family, and Kalath soon became a welcome guest at the imperial palace. Emperor Molvan was an elderly man with but one surviving child, a daughter named Denera, perhaps a year younger than Kalath. Matters between the two youngsters progressed in a not uncommon fashion until Kalath was recalled at 18 to Malzeth to begin his military career. Kalath rose meteorically through the ranks to the position of governor-general of the district of Rakuth by the time he was 28, thereby becoming the youngest man ever elevated to the general staff. A year later, he journeyed to Melusine, where he and Princess Denera were married. In the years that followed, Kalath divided his time between Melusine and Malzeth, building a power base in each, and when Emperor Molvan died in 3829, he was ready. There had been others in line for the throne, but most of these had died, frequently under mysterious circumstances. It was, nonetheless, over the violent objections of many noble families of Melusine that Kalath was declared Emperor of Melusine in 3830. These objections were quieted with brutal efficiency by Kalath's cohorts. Denera had produced 7 healthy children to ensure that Kalath's line would continue. Journeying to Malzeth the following year, Kalath brought the Melusine army to the border of Delshin, where it stood poised. At Malzeth, Kalath delivered an ultimatum to the general staff. His forces comprised the army of his own district of Rakuth and of the eastern principalities in Karand, where the Angarak military governors had sworn allegiance to him. Together with the army on the Delshin border, this gave him absolute military supremacy. His demand was to be appointed over-general of the armies of Angarak. There were precedents. In the past, an occasional general had been granted that office, though it was far more common for the general staff to rule jointly. But Kalath's demand brought something new into the picture. His position as emperor was hereditary, and he insisted that the over-generalship of Angarak also be passed to his heirs. Helplessly, the generals acceded to his demands. Kalath stood supreme on the continent as Emperor of Mersin and Commander-in-Chief of Angarak. The integration of Mersin and Angarak was turbulent, but in the end, Mersin patience won out over Angarak brutality, as it became evident over the years that the Mersin bureaucracy was infinitely more efficient than Angarak military administration. The bureaucracy first moved on such mundane matters as standards and currency. From there, it was but a short step to establishing a continental bureau of roads. Within a few hundred years, the bureaucracy ran virtually every aspect of life on the continent. As always, it gathered up talented men and women from every corner of Meloria, regardless of race. Soon, administrative units comprised of Mersines, Karans, and Dalesians, and Angaraks were not at all uncommon. By 4400, the bureaucratic ascendancy was complete. In the interim, the title of over-general had begun to fall into disuse, perhaps because the bureaucracy customarily addressed all communications to the emperor. There appears to have been no specific date when the Emperor of Mersina became the Emperor of Meloria, and such usage was never formally approved until after the disastrous adventure in the west, which ended in the Battle of Vomimbre. The conversion of Mersines to the worship of Torak was at best superficial. They pragmatically accepted the forms of Angarak worship out of political expediency, but the Grolems were unable to command the abject submission to the dragon god, which had always characterized the Angaraks. In 4850, Torak himself suddenly emerged from his aeons of seclusion at Asheba. A vast shock ran through Meloria as the living god, his maimed face concealed behind a polished steel mask, appeared at the gates of Malzeth. The emperor was disdainfully set aside, and Torak assumed full authority as Kal, king and god. Messengers were dispatched to Tolmyrgos, Mishrek Achtul, and Garagnadrak, and a council of war was held at Malzeth in 4852. The Dalesians, Karans, and Mersines were stunned by the appearance of a figure they had always thought purely mythical, and their shock was compounded by the presence of Torak's disciples. Torak was a god, and did not speak, except to issue commands. But the disciples, Tukchik, Zedar, and Irvon, were men, and they probed and examined everything with a kind of cold disdain. They saw at once that Melorian society had become almost totally secular, and took steps to rectify the situation. A reign of terror descended upon Meloria. Grolems were everywhere, and secularism was a form of heresy to them. The sacrifices, long virtually unknown, were renewed with a fanatic enthusiasm. Soon not a village in all Meloria did not have its altar and reeking bonfire. In one stroke, Torak's disciples overturned millennia of military and bureaucratic rule, and returned absolute dominion to the Grolems. Soon, there was not one facet of Melorian life that did not bow abjectly to the will of Torak. The mobilization of Maloria, in preparation for the war with the West, virtually depopulated the continent, and the disaster at Vomimbre wiped out an entire generation. The catastrophic campaign, coupled with the apparent death of Torak at the hands of the Raven Warder, utterly demoralized Maloria. The doddering old emperor emerged from retirement to try to rebuild the shattered bureaucracy. Grolom efforts to maintain control were met with universal hatred. Without Torak, they had no real power. Most of the emperor's sons had perished at Vomimbre, but one gifted child remained. A boy of 7, the son of his old age. The emperor spent his few remaining years instructing and preparing his son for the task of ruling. When age finally rendered the emperor incompetent, Korzeth, then about 14, callously deposed his father and ascended the imperial throne. After the war, Malorian society had fractured back to its original components of Melsina, Coranda, Dalesia, and Maloria Antiqua. There was even a movement to disintegrate further into the prehistoric kingdoms which had existed before the coming of the Angoraks. This movement was particularly strong in the Principality of Gandahar in southern Malsina, in Zamad and Vorsebo in Coranda, and in Perevor in the Dalesian protectorates. Deceived by Korzeth's youth, these regions rashly declared independence from the imperial throne at Malzeth, and other principalities gave indications that they would soon follow suit. Korzeth moved immediately to stem the tide of revolution. The boy emperor spent the rest of his life on horseback in perhaps the greatest bloodbath in history. But when he was done, he delivered a reunified Maloria to his successor to the throne. The descendants of Korzeth brought a different kind of rule to the continent. Before the disastrous war, the emperor of Maloria had often been little more than a figurehead, and power had largely rested within the bureaucracy. But now, the imperial throne was absolute. The center of power shifted from Melsina to Malzeth, in keeping with the military orientation of Korzeth and his descendants. As is usual when power rests in the hands of one supreme ruler, intrigue became commonplace. Plots and conspiracies abounded as various functionaries schemed to discredit rivals and gain imperial favor. Rather than trying to stop these palace intrigues, Korzeth's descendants encouraged them, perceiving that men divided by mutual distrust could never unite to challenge the power of the throne. The present emperor, Zakath, assumed the throne during his 18th year. Intelligent, sensitive, and capable, he gave early promise of enlightened rule. A personal tragedy, however, turned him from that course and made him a man feared by half of the world. Now he is obsessed with the concept of power, the idea of becoming overking of all of the Angoraks has dominated his thoughts for the past 2 decades. Only time will determine if Zakath will succeed in asserting dominance over the western Angorak kingdoms. But if he succeeds, the history of the entire world may be profoundly altered. Part 1. Melsina. Chapter 1. Her Majesty, Queen Poran of Drasnia, was in a pensive mood. She stood at the window of her pink-frilled sitting room in the palace at Boktor, watching her son Kiva and Unrak, the son of Berak of Trelheim, at play in a garden drenched with morning sunlight. The boys had reached that age where sometimes it seemed almost possible to see them growing, and their voices wavered uncertainly between boyish soprano and manly baritone. Poran sighed, smoothing the front of her black gown. The Queen of Drasnia had worn black since the death of her husband.
You would be proud of him, Rodar,
she whispered sadly. There was a light knock at the door.
Yes,
she replied, not turning.
The Zanadra care to see you, your majesty,
the aged butler at the door reported.
He says you know him.
Oh?
He says his name is Yablik.
Oh, yes, Prince Keldar's associate. Show him in, please.
There's a woman with him, your majesty,
the butler said with a disapproving expression.
She uses language your majesty might prefer not to hear.
Porin smiled warmly.
That must be Vala, she said. I have heard her swear before. I don't know that she's really all that serious about it. Show them both in, if you would, please.
At once, your majesty.
Yarblick was as shabby as ever. At some point, the shoulder seam of his long black overcoat had given way, and had been rudimentarily repaired with a piece of rawhide thong. His beard was coarse and black and scraggly, his hair was unkempt, and he looked as if he didn't smell very good.
Your Majesty, he said grandly,
attempting a bow which was marred a bit by an unsteady lurch.
Drunk already, Master Yarblick?
Porin asked him archly.
No, not really, Porin, he replied unabashed. It's just a little carryover from last night.
The queen was not offended by the Nedrak's use of her first name. Yarblick's grip on formality had never been very firm. The woman who had entered with him was a stunningly beautiful Nedrak, with blue-black hair and smoldering eyes. She was dressed in tight-fitting leather trousers and a black leather vest. A silver-hilted dagger protruded from each of her boot tops, and two more were tucked under the wide leather belt about her waist. She bowed with infinite grace.
You look tired, Porin,
she observed.
I think you need more sleep.
Porin laughed.
Tell that to the people who bring me stacks of parchment every hour or so.
I made myself a rule years ago, Yarblick said,
sprawling uninvited in a chair.
Never put anything down in writing. It saves time as well as keeping me out of trouble.
It seems to me that I have heard Keldar say the same thing.
Yarblick shrugged.
Silph's got a good grip on reality.
I have not seen you two for quite some time,
Porin noted, also sitting.
We have been in Meloria,
Vela told her, wandering around the room and looking appraisingly at the furnishings.
Isn't that dangerous? I have heard that there is a plague there.
Oh, it's pretty much confined to Malzith,
Yarblick replied.
Polgara persuaded the Emperor to seal up the city.
Polgara?
Porin exclaimed, coming to her feet.
What is she doing in Meloria?
She was going in the general direction of a place called Esheba, last time I saw her. She had Belgarath and the others with her.
How did they get to Meloria?
By boat, I would imagine. It's a long swim.
Yarblick, am I going to have to drag every single scrap of information out of you?
Porin demanded in exasperation.
Oh, I'm getting to it, Porin, he said, sounding a little injured. Do you want the story first or the messages? I have got lots of messages for you, and Vela's got a couple more that she won't even talk about. At least not to me.
Just start at the beginning, Yarblick.
Any way you want it.
He scratched at his beard.
The way I got this story is that Silk and Belgarath and the others were in Tol Murgos. They got captured by the Malorians, and Zakath took them all to Marzeth. The young fellow with the big sword. Belgarian, isn't it? Anyway, he and Zakath got to be friends.
Garion and Zakath?
Porin asked incredulously.
How?
I wouldn't know. I wasn't there when it happened. To make it short, they were friends, but then the plague broke out in Marzeth. I managed to sneak Silk and the others out of the city, and we went north. We separated before we got to Vena. They wanted to go to this Ashaba place, and I had a caravan load of goods I wanted to get to Yar Marak. Made a fairly good profit, actually.
Why were they going to Ashaba?
They were after some woman named Zandramas, the one who abducted Belgarian's son.
A woman? Zandramas is a woman?
So they told me. Belgarath gave me a letter for you. It's all in there. I told him that he shouldn't write it down, but he wouldn't listen to me.
Yarblek unwound himself from his chair, fished around inside his overcoat, and handed a rumpled and none too clean piece of parchment to the queen. Then he strolled to the window and looked out.
"Isn't that Trelheim's boy down there? The husky one with the red hair."
Porin was reading the parchment.
"Yes,"
she said absently, trying to concentrate on the message.
"Is he here? Trelheim, I mean."
"Yes. I don't know if he's awake yet, though. He stayed up rather late last night, and he was a little tipsy when he went to bed."
Yarblek laughed.
"That is Barak, all right. Has he got his wife and daughters with him, too?"
"No,"
Porin said.
"They stayed in Val Alorn, making the preparations for his oldest daughter's wedding."
"Is she that old already?"
"Carrick's marry young. They seem to think it is the best way to keep a girl out of trouble. Barak and his son came here to get away from all of the fuss."
Yarblek laughed again.
"I think I will go wake him up and see if he's got anything to drink."
He touched his forefinger to the spot between his eyes with a pained look.
"I am feeling a little delicate this morning. And Barak is a good man to get well with. I'll stop back when I'm feeling better. Besides, you have got your mail to read. Oh, I almost forgot. Here are some others."
He started rummaging around inside his shabby coat.
"One from Polgora." He tossed it negligently on the table. "One from Belgarian. One from Silk. And one from Blonde Girl with the Dimples. The one they call Vevet. The snake didn't send anything. You know how snakes are. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm really not feeling too good."
He lurched to the door and went out.
"That is the most exasperating man in the world," Porin declared.
"He does it on purpose,"
Vela shrugged.
"He thinks it's funny."
"Yarblek said that you have some messages for me, too. I suppose I should read them all at once, get all of the shocks over with at one time."
"I've got only one, Porin,"
Vela replied,
"and it isn't in writing. Lizelle, the one they call Velvet, asked me to tell you something when we were alone."
"All right,"
Porin said, putting down Belgarath's letter.
"I'm not sure how they found out about this,"
Vela said,
"but it seems that the king of Tol Burgos is not the son of Tar Ugas."
"What are you saying, Vela?"
"Urgot is not even related to that frothing lunatic. It seems that a number of years ago, a certain Drasnian businessman paid a visit to the palace in Ratgoska. He and Tar Ugas' second wife became friendly."
She smiled with one eyebrow slightly raised.
"Very friendly? I always had that suspicion about Murgo women. Anyway, Urgot was the result of that friendship."
A terrible suspicion began to dawn on Queen Porin. Vela grinned impishly at her.
"We all knew that Silk had royal connections. We just didn't know how many royal families he was connected to."
"No,"
Porin gasped. Vela laughed.
"Oh, yes. Lysel confronted Urgot's mother with it, and the lady confessed."
The Nadrak girl's face grew serious.
The whole point of Lassell's message is that Silk does not want that bony fellow Javelin to find out about it. Lassell felt that she had to report it to somebody. That's why she told me to pass it on to you. I guess you are supposed to decide whether to tell Javelin or not.
How very kind of her, Porin said dryly.
Now they want me to keep secrets from the chief of my own intelligence service.
Vela's eyes twinkled.
Lassell's in a kind of difficult situation, Porin. I know that I drank too much and I swear a lot. That makes people think I'm stupid, but I'm not. Nadrak women know the world, and I have very good eyes. I didn't actually catch them at it, but I'd be willing to wager half the money I'll get when Yarblick sells me that Silk and Lassell are keeping company.
Vela?
Well, I couldn't prove it, Porin, but I know what I saw.
The Nadrak girl sniffed at her leather vest and made a sour face.
If it's not too much trouble, I would really like to take a bath. I've been in the saddle for weeks. Horses are nice enough animals, I suppose, but I really don't want to smell like one.
Porin's mind was working very fast now to give herself time to think. She rose and approached the wild Nadrak girl.
Have you ever worn satin, Vela? A gown, perhaps?
Satin? Me?
Vela laughed coarsely.
Nadraks never wear satin.
Then you might be the very first.
Queen Porin reached out her small white hands and lifted Vela's wealth of blue-black hair into a tumbled mass atop her head.
I would give my soul for hair like that, she murmured.
I'll trade you,
Vela offered.
Do you know what price I could bring if I were blonde?
Hush, Vela,
Porin said absently.
I'm trying to think.
She twined the girl's hair loosely about her hands, startled at how alive it felt. Then she reached out, lifted Vela's chin, and looked into her huge eyes. Something seemed to reach out and touch the Queen of Dresnia, and she suddenly knew the destiny of this half-wild child in front of her.
Oh, my dear,
she almost laughed.
What an amazing future you have in store for you. You will touch the sky, Vela, the very sky.
I really don't know what you're talking about, Porin.
You will.
Porin looked at the perfect face before her.
Yes, she said. Satin, I think. Lavender would be nice.
I prefer red.
No, dear,
Porin told her.
Red just would not do. It definitely has to be lavender.
She reached out and touched the girl's ears.
And I think amethyst here and here.
What are you up to?
It is a game, child. Dresnians are very good at games. And when I am done, I will double your price.
Porin was just a bit smug about it.
Bathe first. Then let's see what we can do with you.
Vela shrugged.
As long as I can keep my daggers.
We'll work that out.
Can you really do something with a lump like me?
Vela asked almost plaintively.
Oh, trust me,
Porin said, smiling.
Now, go bathe, child. I have letters to read and decisions to make.
After the Queen of Dresnia had read the letters, she summoned her butler and issued a couple of orders.
I want to speak with the Earl of Trelheim, she said, before he gets any drunker. I also need to talk with Javelin just as soon as he can get to the palace.
It was perhaps 10 minutes later when Barak appeared in the doorway. He was a bit bleary-eyed, and his vast red beard stuck out in all directions. Yarblick came with him.
Put away your tankards, gentlemen,
Porin said crisply.
There is work to be done. Barak is the seabird ready to sail.
She's always ready, he said in an injured tone.
Good. Then round up your sailors. You have a number of places to go. I'm calling a meeting of the Elon Council. get word to Anheg, Fulvarak, and Bran's son Kael at Riva. Stop off in Arindi and pick up Mandorallan and Leldorin.
She pursed her lips.
Corodulan is not well enough to travel, so bypass Pomimbre. He would get out of his deathbed to attend if he knew what was going on. Go to Tolhanath instead and get Varanna. I will send word to Kohag and Hetar myself. Yarblek, you go to Yarnadrak and get Rosta. Leave Vela here with me.
But...
No, but, Yarblek. Do exactly as I say.
I thought you said this was a meeting of the Elwhan Council, Boren, Barak objected. Why are we inviting the Aerons and the Tolnedrons and the Nadraks?
We have got an emergency on our hands, Barak, and it concerns everybody.
They stood staring stupidly at her. She clapped her hands together sharply.
Quickly, gentlemen, quickly. We don't have any time to waste.
Birgit, High King of Tol Murgos, sat on his garish throne in the Drojum Palace at Rak Urga. He was dressed in his favorite purple doublet and hose. He had one leg negligently cocked over the arm of the throne, and he was absently tossing his crown back and forth between his hands as he listened to the droning voice of Agachak, the cadaverous-looking hierarch of Rak Urga.
"It's going to have to wait, Agachak," he said finally. "I am getting married next month." "This is a command of the church, Agit."
"Wonderful. Give the church my regards."
Agachak looked taken aback.
"You don't believe in anything now, do you, my king?"
"Not very much, no. Is this sick world we live in ready for atheism yet?"
For the first time in his life, Urgot saw doubt on the face of the hierarch.
"Atheism is a clean place, Agachak. A flat, grey, empty place where a man makes his own destiny and let the gods go hang. I didn't make them. They didn't make me. And we are quits on all of that. I wish them well, though."
"This is unlike you, Urgot," Agachak said.
"No, not really. I am just tired of playing the clown."
He stretched out his leg and tossed his crown at his foot like a hoop. He caught it and kicked it back again.
"You don't really understand, do you, Agachak?" he said as he caught the crown out of midair.
The hierarch of Rak Urga drew himself up.
"This is not a request, Urgot. I am not asking you."
"Good, because I'm not going."
"I command you to go."
"I don't think so."
"Do you realize to whom you are talking?"
"Oh, perfectly, old boy. You are the same tiresome old Grolum who has been boring me to tears ever since I inherited the throne from that fellow who used to chew on the carpets back in Rakuska. Listen carefully, Agachak. I'll use short words and simple sentences so that I don't confuse you. I am not going to Meloria. I have never had any intention of going to Meloria. There is nothing I want to see in Meloria. There's nothing I want to do there. I most definitely do not intend to put myself anywhere near Kerzakath, and he has gone back to Malzeth. Not only that, they have demons in Meloria. Have you ever seen a demon, Agachak?"
"Once or twice," the hierarch replied sullenly.
"And you are still going to Meloria? Agachak, you are as crazy as Tower Urgas was."
"I can make you king of all Angarak."
"I don't want to be king of all Angarak. I don't even want to be king of Tol Murgos. All I want is to be left alone to contemplate the horror that is about to descend on me."
"Your marriage, you mean?"
Agachak's face grew sly.
"You could evade that by coming to Meloria with me."
Have I been going too fast for you, Agachak? A wife is bad enough. Demons are much worse. Did anybody ever tell you what that thing did to Kabat?
Urgot shuddered.
I can protect you.
Urgot laughed scornfully.
You, Agachak? You couldn't even protect yourself. Even Polgora had to have help from a god to deal with that monster. Do you plan to resurrect Torak to give you a hand? Or maybe you could appeal to Aldor. He's the one that helped Polgora. I don't really think he'd like you, though. I don't even like you. And I've known you all my life.
You go too far, Agat.
No, not far enough, Agachak. 4 centuries, aeons probably. You Grolems have held the upper hand in Tol Mergos, but that was when Tuchik was still alive, and Tuchik is dead now. You did know about that, didn't you, old boy? He tried his hand against Belgorath, and Belgorath disassembled him right down to the floor. I may be the only Murgo alive who has ever met Belgorath and lived to talk about it. We're actually on fairly good terms. Would you like to meet him? I could probably arrange an introduction if you would like it.
Agachak visibly shrank back.
Ha! Much better, Agachak,
Urgot said smoothly.
I'm delighted at your grasp of the realities of the situation. Now, I'm certain that you can raise your hand and wiggle your fingers at me, but now I know how to recognize that sort of thing. I watched Belgarion rather closely while we were trotting across Tacha last winter. If your hand moves even a fraction of an inch, you're going to get about a bushel basket full of arrows right in the middle of the back. The archers are already in place, and their bows are already drawn. Give it some thought, Agachak, while you're leaving.
This is not like you, Urgot,
Agachak said, his nostrils white with fury.
I know. Delightful, isn't it? You may go now, Agachak.
The Hierarch spun on his heel and started toward the door.
Oh, by the way, old boy,
Urgot added,
I've had news that our dear brother Gethel of Tuldum recently died. Was probably something he ate. Tulls eat almost anything that swims, flies, crawls, or spawns on rotten meat. It's a pity, actually. Gethel was one of the few people in the world I could bully. Anyway, he has been succeeded on the throne by his half-wit son, Nathal. I've met Nathal. He has the mentality of an earthworm. But he's a true Angorak king. Why don't you see if he wants to go to Meloria with you? It might take you a while to explain to him where Meloria is, since I think he believes that the world is flat. But I have every confidence in you, Agachak.
Urgot flipped his hand at the fuming Hierarch.
Run along now. Go back to your temple and gut a few more Grolems. Maybe you can even get the fires started in your sanctum again. If nothing else, I'm sure it will calm your nerves.
Agachak stormed out, slamming the door behind him. Urgot doubled over, pounding on the arm of his throne and howling with glee.
Don't you think you might have gone just a bit too far, my son?
Lady Tamazin asked from the shadowy alcove, where she had been listening in.
Oh, perhaps so, mother,
he agreed, still laughing.
But wasn't it fun?
She limped into the light and smiled fondly at him.
Yes, Urgot, it was. But don't push Agachak too far. He can be a dangerous enemy.
Oh, I've got lots of enemies, mother,
Urgot said, tugging unconsciously at his long, pointed nose.
Most of the people in the world hate me. But I have learned to live with that. It is not as if I had to run for re-election, you know.
The bleak-faced Seneschal Oskatat also came out of the shadowed alcove.
What are we going to do with you, Urgot?
He said wryly.
What did Belgarion teach you, anyway?
He taught me how to be a king, Oskatat. I may not last very long, but by the gods, as long as I am here, I am going to be a king. Well, they're going to kill me anyway, so I might as well enjoy myself while I can.
His mother sighed, then raised her hands helplessly.
There is no reasoning with him, Oscar.
I suppose not, my Lady Tamazin, the gray-haired man agreed.
Princess Prala wants to speak with you,
Tamazin said to her son.
I am at her immediate disposal, Urgot said. Not only immediate, but perpetual, if I understand the terms of the marriage contract.
Be nice,
Tamazin chided.
Yes, mother.
The Princess Prala, of the House of Ch'than, swept in through a side door. She wore a riding habit consisting of a calf-length black skirt, a white satin blouse, and polished boots. Her heels hit the marble floor like little hammers, her long black hair swayed at her back, and her eyes were dangerous. She held a parchment scroll in her hands.
"Will you assist me, my Lord Oscar?"
Lady Tamazin asked, holding one hand out to the seneschal.
"Of course, my lady,"
he replied, offering his arm to Urgot's mother with tender solicitude. The two of them withdrew.
"Now what?" Urgot warily asked his bride-to-be.
"Am I disturbing your majesty?"
Prala asked. She did not bother to curtsy. The princess had changed. She was no longer a properly submissive Murgo lady. The time she had spent with Queen Zinedra and the Margravine Lazelle had definitely corrupted her, Urgot felt, and the unwholesome influence of Pulgara the sorceress showed in her every move and gesture. She was, however, Urgot concluded, absolutely adorable now. Her black eyes flashed, her delicate white skin seemed to reflect her mood, and her wealth of black hair seemed almost alive as it flowed down her back. Rather surprisingly, Urgot found that he was very fond of her.
"You always disturb me, my beloved," he answered her question, spreading his arms extravagantly.
"Stop that,"
she snapped.
"You sound like your brother."
"It runs in the family."
"Did you put this in here?"
she demanded, waving the scroll at him like a club.
"Did I put what in where?"
"This."
She unrolled the scroll.
"It is agreed that the Princess Prala, of the House of Ch'than, shall be His Majesty's most favored wife."
She read it again.
"Most favored wife?"
came out from between clenched teeth.
"Oh, what's wrong with that?"
he asked, a little surprised at the girl's vehemence.
"The implication is that there will be others."
"Oh, it's the custom, Prala. I did not make the rules."
"You are the king. Make different rules."
"Me?"
he swallowed hard.
"There will be no other wives, Urgot, or royal concubines."
Her usually gentle voice seemed to crackle.
"You are mine, and I am not going to share you with anybody."
"Do you really feel that way?"
he asked, a bit amazed.
"Yes, I do."
She lifted her chin.
"Nobody has ever felt that way about me before."
"Get used to it."
Her voice was flat and had the overtone of daggers in it.
"We will amend the passage," he agreed quickly. "I don't need more than one wife anyway."
"Definitely not, my lord. A very wise decision."
"Naturally. All royal decisions are wise. It says so in the history books."
She tried very hard not to smile, but finally gave up, and then laughed and hurled herself into his arms.
"Oh, Urgot."
She burrowed her face into his neck.
"I do love you."
"You do? What an amazing thing."
Suddenly an idea came to him, and its sheer purity almost blinded him.
What's your feeling about a double wedding, love?
She pulled her face back from where she had been grazing on his neck.
I don't quite follow you, she admitted.
I'm the king, right?
A little more than you were before you met Belgarion,
she admitted. He let that pass. I've got this female relative. I'm going to be busy being married.
Oh, very busy, my love,
she agreed.
He coughed nervously.
Anyway, he rushed on, I'm not really going to have all that much time to look after this certain female relative, am I? Wouldn't it be better if I married her off to some deserving fellow who has always held her in the highest regard?
I don't quite follow you, Urgot. I didn't think you had any female relatives.
Only one, my princess, he grinned at her. Only one. She stared at him.
Urgot,
she gasped.
He gave her a rat-faced little grin.
I am the king, he said grandly. I can do anything I want to do, and my mother has been alone for far too long, wouldn't you say? Oscatat has loved her since she was a girl, and she's at least fond of him. Although I think it might go a little farther than that. If I order them to get married, they'd have to do it, wouldn't they?
That's absolutely brilliant, Urgot,
she marveled. It comes from my Drasnian heritage, he admitted modestly. Kelda himself could not have come up with a neater scheme.
It's perfect,
she almost squealed.
This way I won't have a mother-in-law interfering when I start changing you.
Changing?
Just a few little things, love,
she said sweetly.
You have a few bad habits, and your taste in clothing is terrible. Whatever possessed you to start wearing purple?
Anything else?
I'll bring the list with me next time I visit.
Urgot began to have second thoughts at that point. His Imperial Majesty, Kal-Zakath of Meloria, had a busy morning that day. Most of the time he was closeted with Braedor, chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs, in a small blue-draped office on the second floor of the palace.
"It's definitely subsiding, Your Majesty,"
Braedor reported when the subject of the plague came up.
"There hasn't been a new case in the past week, and a surprising number of people are actually recovering. The plan of walling off each separate district of the city seems to have worked."
"It's good,"
Zakath said. He turned to another matter.
"Is there any further word out of Karanda?"
Braedor shuffled through the papers he was holding.
"Minga hasn't been seen for several weeks now, Your Majesty."
The chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs smiled briefly.
"That particular plague also seems to be subsiding. The demons appear to have left, and the fanatics are losing heart."
He tapped one of the papers against his pursed lips.
"It's only an educated guess, Your Majesty, since I can't get any agents into the region. But the turmoil appears to have shifted to the east coast. Shortly after Minga disappeared, large bodies of Karandi's irregular troops, along with Irvan's temple guardsmen and his kandam, crossed the mountains of Samad. And all communications out of Rasibo and Rengel have broken down."
"Irvan?" Zakath asked.
"It appears so, Your Majesty. I'd say that the disciple is moving into position for a final confrontation with Zandramas. One is tempted to suggest that we just let them fight it out. I don't think that the world would miss either of them very much."
A faint, icy smile touched Zakath's lips.
"You are right, Braedor. It is tempting. But I don't think we should encourage that sort of thing, just as a matter of policy. Those principalities are a part of the Empire, and they are entitled to Imperial protection. It might start some ugly rumors if we were to just stand idly by and let Irvan and Zandramas rip up the countryside. If anybody brings military force to Baron Meloria, it is going to be me.
He leafed through the papers on the table in front of him, picked one up and frowned at it.
Oh, I suppose we had better deal with this. Where have you got Baron Vaska?
He's in a cell with a splendid view, Brador replied. He can look out at the executioner's block. I'm sure it's been most educational.
Zakath remembered something then.
Demote him, he said. Well, that's another word for the procedure, Brador murmured. That is not exactly what I meant,
Zakath said with another chill smile.
Persuade him to tell us where he hid all of the money he extorted from the people that he dealt with. We will transfer the funds to the Imperial Treasury.
He turned to look at the large map on the wall of his study.
Southern Ebal, I think.
Your Majesty?
Brador looked puzzled.
Assign him to the post of Minister of Trade in Southern Ebal.
There isn't any trade in Southern Ebal, Your Majesty. There aren't any seaports, and the only thing they raise in the timber marshes is mosquitoes.
Vaska is inventive. I am sure that he will come up with something.
Then you don't want him?
Brador made a suggestive gesture across his throat with one hand.
No, Zakath said. I am going to try something Belgarian suggested. I may need Vaska again someday, and I don't want to have to dig him up in pieces.
A faintly pained look crossed the Emperor's face.
Has there been any word about him?
Vaska? I just...
No.
Belgarian.
They were seen shortly after they left Malzeth, Your Majesty. They were traveling with Prince Kaldar's Nadrak partner, Yarblek. Not long after that, Yarblek sailed for Garag Nadrak. It was all a ruse, then,
Zakath sighed. All Belgarian really wanted was to get back to his own country. That wild story of theirs was made up out of whole cloth.
Zakath passed a weary hand in front of his eyes.
I really liked that young man, Brador. I should have known better.
Belgarian didn't go back to the West, Your Majesty,
Brador informed him.
At least not with Yarblek. We always check that fellow's ships rather closely. So far as we are able to determine, Belgarian has not left Meloria.
Zakath leaned back with a genuine smile on his face.
I am not sure why, but that makes me feel better. The thought that he betrayed me was quite painful for some reason. Any idea about where he has gone?
There was some turmoil in Katakor, Your Majesty. Up around Ashaba. It was the sort of thing one might associate with Belgarian. Strange lights in the sky, explosions, that sort of thing.
Zakath laughed out loud, a delighted kind of laugh.
He can be a little ostentatious when he is irritated, can't he? He blew the whole wall out of my bedchamber in Rahaga one time.
Who?
He was trying to make a point.
There was a respectful rap at the door.
Come, Zakath replied shortly.
General Ateska has arrived, Your Majesty.
One of the red-garbed guards at the door reported.
Good. Send him in.
The broken-nosed general entered and saluted smartly.
Your Majesty,
he said. His red uniform was travel-stained.
You made good time, Ateska,
Zakath said.
It is good to see you again.
Thank you, Your Majesty. We had a good following wind, and the sea was calm.
How many men did you bring with you?
About 50,000.
How many men do we have now?
Zakath asked Brador.
Something in excess of 1,000,000, Your Majesty.
That is a solid number. Let's stage up the troops and get ready to move.
He rose and went to the window. The leaves had begun to turn, filling the garden below with bright reds and yellows.
I want to quiet things down on the east coast. And it's turning into autumn now. So, I think we want to move the troops before the weather starts to deteriorate. We will go on down to Magarin and send out scouting parties from there. If the circumstances are right, we will march. If not, we can wait at Magarin for more troops to come back from Tolmurgos.
I'll get started on that immediately, Your Majesty.
Brador bowed and quietly left the room.
Sit down, Ateska,
the Emperor said.
What is happening in Tolmurgos? We are going to try to hold the cities we have already taken, Your Majesty,
Ateska reported, drawing up a chair.
We've gathered the bulk of our forces near Rakhtan. They are waiting there for transport to bring them back to Meloria.
Any chance that Urgot might try a counterattack?
I would not think so, Your Majesty. I don't believe he will gamble his army in open country. Of course, you never know what a Murgo might do.
That's true,
Zakath agreed. He kept his knowledge that Urgot was not actually a Murgo to himself. He leaned back.
You captured Belgarion for me once, Ateska.
Yes, Your Majesty.
I am afraid you are going to have to do it again. He managed to get away. Careless of me, I suppose. But I had a lot on my mind at the time.
We'll just have to pick him up again then, won't we, Your Majesty?
The Aelorn Council met at Boktor that year. Somewhat uncharacteristically, Queen Porin took charge. The tiny blonde queen of Dresnia, dressed in her usual black, walked quietly to the head of the table in the red-draped council chamber in the palace and took the chair normally reserved for the Riven King. The others stared at her in astonishment.
"Gentlemen," she began crisply, "I recognize the fact that this flies in the face of tradition. But our time is limited. Certain information has come to me that I think you should be made aware of. We have decisions to make and very little time in which to make them."
Emperor Varana leaned back in his chair with an amused twinkle in his eyes.
"We will now pause while the Aelorn kings go into collective apoplexy," he said.
King Anheg scowled at the curly-haired emperor for a moment and then laughed.
"No, Varana. We all got that out of our systems when Hrodar persuaded us to follow Synedra into Mishraq Achtul. It is Porin's house. Let her run things."
"I thank you, Anheg."
The Queen of Dresnia actually sounded a little surprised. She paused, gathering her thoughts.
"As I am sure you have noticed, our gathering this year includes kings who would not normally attend. The matter before us, however, concerns us all. I have recently received communications from Belgrath, Belgarion, and the others."
There was an excited stir in the room. Porin held up one hand.
"They are in Meloria, close on the trail of the abductor of Belgarion's son."
"A young man can move faster than the wind sometimes," King Fulrak of Sundaria observed.
The years had given Fulrak a tendency toward portliness, and his brown beard was now streaked with silver.
"How did they get to Meloria?" King Kohag asked in a quiet voice.
"It seems that they were captured by Khal Zakath,"
Porin replied.
"Geryon and Zakath became friends, and Zakath took them with him when he returned to Malzeth."
"Zakath actually became friends with somebody?"
King Drosta of Garagnadrak demanded incredulously in his shrill voice.
"Impossible!"
"Geryon has a way about him sometimes," Etar murmured.
"The friendship, however, may have run its course," Porin continued. "Late one night, Geryon and his friends slipped out of Malzeth without saying goodbye to the Emperor."
"With the whole Imperial army on their trail, I would imagine," Varana added.
"No,"
Porin disagreed.
Sakath cannot leave Malzeth just now. Tell them, Yarblek.
Silk's rangy partner rose to his feet.
They have got a plague in Malzeth, he said. Sakath has sealed up the city. No one can go in or out.
Prithee? Mandaralan asked. How then was it possible for our good friends to make good their escape?
I had picked up an itinerant comedian, Yarblek said sourly. I didn't think much of him, but he amused Vela. She is fond of body stories.
Be careful, Yarblek,
the Nedrek dancer warned.
You still have your health, but I can fix that for you.
She put one hand suggestively on a dagger hilt. Vela wore a stunning lavender gown. There were a few concessions to Nedrek customs in her dress, however. She still wore polished leather boots with daggers in their tops, and the customary wide leather belt about her waist was still adorned with similar knives. The men in the room, however, had all been surreptitiously eyeing her since she had entered. No matter how she was dressed, Vela still had the power to attract every eye.
Anyway, Yarblek hurried on, the fellow knew of a tunnel that runs from the palace to an abandoned quarry outside the city. It got us all out of Malzeth with no one the wiser.
Zakath,
one like that, Drosta said. He hates to let people go once he has caught them.
There has been an uprising of some sort in the Seven Kingdoms of Karanda in northern Maloria,
Boren went on.
I understand that there are demons involved.
Demons? Varana said skeptically. Oh, come now, Boren.
That is what Belgarath reports.
Belgarath has a warped sense of humor sometimes, Varana scoffed. He was probably just joking. There is no such thing as a demon. You're wrong, Varana, King Drosta said with uncharacteristic soberness. I saw one once, up in Murrindland when I was a boy.
What did it look like? Varana did not sound convinced. Drosta shuddered.
You really don't want to know.
At any rate, Boren said, Sakath has ordered the bulk of his army back from Tol Murgos to put down this uprising. It won't be very long until he floods the entirety of Karanda with troops, and that is the area where our friends are. That is why I have called this meeting. What are we going to do about it?
Lulduran of Wildentor came to his feet.
We will need fast horses, he said to Hetar.
Why? Hetar asked.
To get to their aid, of course.
The young Astorian's eyes were flashing with excitement.
Lulduran, Beric said gently. The Sea of the East is between here and Meloria.
Oh,
Lulduran said, looking slightly abashed.
I did not know that. We'll need a boat too, won't we?
Barak and Hetar exchanged a long look.
Ship, Barak corrected absently.
What?
Oh, never mind, Lulduran, Barak sighed. We can't, King Anheg said flatly. Even if we could get through, we would destroy Geryon's chances of winning in the fight with the Child of Dark. That's what the Seeress told us at Rehan, remember?
But this is different,
Lulduran protested, tears standing in his eyes.
No, Anheg said, it is not. This is exactly what we were warned against. We cannot go near them until this is over.
But,
Lulduran, Anheg said, I want to go as much as you do, but we can't. Would Geryon thank us if we were responsible for the loss of his son?
Mandaralan rose to his feet and began to pace up and down, his armor clinking.
Methinks thy reasoning is right, your majesty, he said to Anheg. We may not join with our friends, lest our presence imperil their quest. And we would all give up our lives to prevent that. We may, however,
journey straight away to Meloria, and without going near them, place ourselves between them and the hordes of Kalzakath. We can thereby bring the unfriendly advance of the Melorians to a precipitous halt, and thus allow Geryon to escape."
Barak stared at the great knight, whose face shone with unthinking zeal. Then he groaned and buried his face in his hands.
"There, there,"
Hittar murmured, patting the big man sympathetically on the shoulder. King Folrak rubbed at his beard.
"Why does it seem that we have done this before?"
he asked.
"It's the same as last time. We have to create a diversion to help our friends get through. Any ideas?"
"Invade Meloria?"
Drasta said eagerly.
"Sack the cat's coastline,"
Unhig said just as eagerly. Porin sighed.
"We could invade Tol Morgos,"
Kohag suggested thoughtfully.
"Yes,"
Hittar agreed fiercely. Kohag held up his hand.
"Only as a ruse, my son. The Kath has committed forces to the conquest of Tol Morgos. If the armies of the West moved into that region, he'd almost be obliged to try to counter us, wouldn't he?"
Varana slid lower in his chair.
"It's got possibilities," he admitted. "But it is already autumn, and the mountains of Tol Morgos are brutal in the winter. It's a bad time to move troops around down there. An army cannot move very fast on frozen feet. I think we might be able to accomplish the same thing by diplomacy, without risking a single toe."
"Thrust the Tulnedrin to be devious," Unheg growled.
"Do you like freezing, Unheg?" Varana asked.
Unheg shrugged.
"It's something to do in the winter time."
Varana rolled his eyes ceilingward.
"Ah, Lorns," he said.
"All right," Unheg said by way of apology. "I was only joking. What is this brilliantly devious plan of yours?"
Varana looked across the room at Javelin.
"How good is the Melorian Intelligence Service, Margrave Kendon?"
he asked bluntly. Javelin rose to his feet, straightened his pearl-gray doublet.
"By himself, Praetor is very good, Your Imperial Majesty. His people are sometimes awkward and obvious, but he has a lot of them. He has unlimited money to work with."
He cast a slightly reproachful glance at Queen Porin.
"Be nice, Kendon," she murmured. "I am on a tight budget."
"Yes, ma'am."
He bowed with a faint smile, then straightened and spoke in a crisp, businesslike manner.
"Malorian intelligence is crude by our standards, but Braedor has the resources to put as many agents into the field as he needs. Neither Drasnia nor Tonedrin intelligence has that process, but they can usually get the information."
He sniffed disdainfully.
"I prefer a neater type of operation, personally."
"Then this Braedor has operatives in Rak Urga?"
Varana pressed.
"Almost certainly,"
Javelin replied.
"I have four in the Drojan Palace at this time myself, and Your Majesty's services too that I know of."
"I did not know that,"
Varana said with an innocent look.
"Really?"
Varana laughed.
"All right,"
he went on.
"What would Zakath do if word reached Malzeth that the kingdoms of the West were about to conclude a military alliance with the King of Morgodom?"
Javelin began to pace up and down.
"It's very hard to know exactly what Zakath will do in any given situation,"
he mused.
"A lot depends on just how serious his domestic problems are.
But an alliance between the Morgos and the West would pose a major threat to Meloria. He would almost have to come back immediately and make an all-out effort to crush the Morgos before our troops could reinforce them. "Ally ourselves with the Morgos?" Hetar exclaimed. "Never!"
"Nobody's suggesting a real alliance, my lord Hetar," Kale, the son of the Riven Warder, told him. "All we want to do is to distract Zakath for long enough to give Belgarion the time to slip past him. The negotiations can drag on and then fall apart later on."
"Oh," Hetar said, looking a bit abashed. "That is different then, I suppose."
"All right," Varana went on crisply. "Perhaps we can persuade Zakath that we are about to conclude an alliance with Urgot if we do it right. Javelin, have your people kill a few Malorian agents in the Trojan Palace. Not all of them, mind you. Just enough to convince Malzeth that this is a serious diplomatic effort."
"I understand perfectly, Your Majesty," Javelin smiled. "I have just the man, a recently recruited Nyssen assassin, Nidaisis."
"Good. A possible alliance will serve the same purpose as a real one. We can distract Zakath without the loss of a single man. Unless we count on this Isis fellow."
"Don't worry about Isis, Your Majesty," Javelin assured him. "He is a survivor."
"I think we're missing something," Anheg growled. "I wish Rodar were here."
"Yes,"
Porin agreed, in a voice near to tears.
"I'm sorry, Porin," Anheg said, engulfing her tiny hand in his huge one. "But you know what I mean."